lovely to be here again. Thank you once again for inviting me. This is week two in a four-part series on the four Brahma Viharas. And because there are new people here tonight, and also because we had some malfunction recording, which I am very skilled at doing that, creating recording malfunctions. Because of that, and because it's a good thing to review, we'll review again the general information, a little bit about the Brahma Viharas, the Brahma Vihara practice, loving kindness practice as the foundation of the four Brahma Viharas. And then tonight we'll also talk about Karuna, compassion practice. And next week we'll do a little faster review. And again, loving kindness, compassion, and then mudita, sympathetic joy. And the final week we'll work up to upeka, equanimity practice. So first I'd like to read you the words of the Buddha, the sutra on loving kindness. The Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and not demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later disapprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, the medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world of suffering. That's the Metta Sutta, the scripture on loving kindness meditation. Loving kindness. And now we discuss loving kindness meditation. So the practices of the four Brahma Viharas, these are the four divine abodes, the sublime abidings. One would imagine maybe the heart, the emotions, the feeling energy of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, saints and sages. What would the heart energy be like? If these beings would radiate immeasurable loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So those are the four Brahma Viharas, four aspects of the enlightened heart, the awakened heart. Loving kindness for all beings, compassion for beings who suffer, appreciative joy for those who are experiencing happiness and success, happy that they're happy, and equanimity, which is both balance of heart and equalness, so that an enlightened being, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, feel this toward all beings equally, equanimity. So that's quite a wonderful thing, quite inspirational. But then we realize that we're not there. We're where we are. And as Pema Chodron would say, we have to start where we are. So we have these wonderful practices introduced to us, which as a complement to our mindfulness and insight practices, help us cultivate and strengthen these aspects of the heart. And they're put together very clearly and carefully with ways of training, a sequence and a pattern, so that we can start where we are and strengthen our hearts and practice the opening of our hearts. So we begin where it is easier. And thus, with the loving kindness practice, we start with reflecting on a benefactor, someone who we already have the feeling of loving kindness toward. And this is, again, like we might think of, like in a chorus, they use a pitch pipe to get the right note so that when the singing begins, everyone is singing the right note. When we practice loving kindness, it's a good idea to be able to, if possible, feel what that feels like. So very skillfully, the technique is that we think of a benefactor being so that we know what it feels like to feel loving kindness. And then we begin the repetition of the phrases. And I've given you the phrases that I've sort of come up with over time and practiced with loving kindness. As you read various people, you'll see various variations and so forth. And then you might develop your own group of phrases for loving kindness. The key aspect of that will be to be careful, take care that your phrases don't have a little subtle criticism in them. For example, may I be less of a procrastinator? So that's if they, we want them to really have this generous heart of loving kindness. And then some people wonder why the repetition. This is because, once again, the techniques are very practical, very oriented toward reality. And the reality is that we are constantly repeating thoughts in our minds anyway. Many of them are not quite as happy or quite as complimentary. And certainly if we have a lot of difficulty with self-aversion, self-criticism, self-judgment, guilt, shame, blame, and so forth, a lot of our thoughts about ourselves are not very complimentary. So when we knock something over, we think, oh, I'm so clumsy, or I'm an idiot, or I'm not good at this, I'm not good at that. So these thoughts repeat in our minds, and of course we also have a lot of repeating thoughts about others, or habitual thoughts about others. My example is often our 20th and 21st century challenge for loving kindness that wasn't available on the planet before that time, which is driving in traffic. Because when someone cuts us off, then what do we say out loud or in our minds? Usually not a phrase of loving kindness. So the notion is to face this. We have habitually conditioned thought patterns. So repeating the phrases of loving kindness again and again and again is designed to help us reprogram that inner tape. So we've got other options. And eventually, over time, it takes a while. It doesn't take nearly as long as the amount of years we've put in with the other tapes repeating. But it does take some time. We will have other habitual thoughts, other choices. So that's really just very practical. Keep repeating a thought again and again, and eventually it'll get more habituated. So we repeat the phrases when we do the practice again and again and again. Then it's nice if we feel the feeling of loving kindness, and we do quite often when we're thinking of the benefactor and maybe our dear friends. But also, if you do this practice over an hour or even a whole day or even a week, there's going to be times when you're just not feeling loving kindness. But again, you keep repeating the phrases anyway. You can also, if you want, bounce back to a thought of the benefactor, which will help you bring back that feeling. Vietnamese Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh mentions putting a smile on our face, and then modern science has discovered that that's actually true, that the smile will change many, many muscles and will change the feeling or the mood, the body chemistry even. So you can, that's a skillful way to do it. Someone here mentioned last week to me that one of the teachers up from Woodinville, one of the monks, suggested also to imagine a time when there was a lot of happiness or a situation of happiness in our lives. So that's a skillful way of working to bring up the feeling. But also know that if you're doing intensive loving kindness practice, you might not have the feeling. And to keep repeating the phrases anyway, again and again, because that will have the benefit of creating the habit in the mind. Also, the whole practice can be used in that way as a concentration practice. And it's actually so effective because although with our breath practice, we do know that if we wake up and we find ourselves thinking, we're to let go of the focus on the thinking and return to the breath. But still, so often we're sort of tempted. We have some thoughts that are sort of Dharma thoughts and Dharma reflections. So we're tempted into thinking, well, these are probably okay just for a while here before I go back to the breath. But what's wonderful about the loving kindness practice, say you're doing a day of loving kindness, a loving kindness retreat. So you would be instructed to repeat the phrases again and again and again when you're sitting meditation, and then when you get up to do walking meditation, and when you go to the restroom, and when you go to lunch, and when you do anything at all. Basically every waking moment, brushing your teeth, taking your shower, keep repeating these phrases. So then it becomes so easy to know when you're distracted because the phrases aren't repeating. And then it's just simple. Go back. That's it. There's no temptation to think other thoughts or other topics or to daydream. It's just very, it's like the computer. What is that word that I always forget?
Binary.
Thank you. Binary. It's a binary thing. The phrases are either moving through our minds or they're not. If they're not, we go back to them. So my experience, and actually others have mentioned that to me, that after doing intensive loving kindness practice, their mindfulness practice got much stronger because it just became very clear. We're either on our breath, if we're focusing on the breath, or we're thinking. If we're thinking, let go of thinking, go back to the breath. That's it. Also binary. So it's either on or off. So it's a wonderful concentration practice in that way, and it can lead to very strong, powerful concentration states. So I did the loving-kindness practice over 3 months as a jhana practice and worked with the jhana states from the concentration. So there's that aspect of it too, but that also involves repeating the phrases. And for me, now people are individual, but my experience was that in addition to the repetition of the phrases and kind of the thought and the feeling of loving kindness, after a while I also felt
a sensation of loving kindness as though it had a shape, as though there were an energy coming from my heart that had a shape. It's actually kind of this shape like this. Compassion was shaped a little differently, and joy was more. But in any case, so I was able to actually feel, use that shape, that feeling of a shape, of energy, as part of the concentration practice as well, which really strengthened it. So there's ways to work. And you'll notice as you do reading and when you hear about the loving kindness from other teachers that there are different ways, different perspectives, and so forth. But of course, as I always say, Sharon Salzberg wrote the book on loving kindness because her first book, Loving Kindness, is so excellent. It really has very, very clear instructions for all four of the Brahma-Vihara practices. And then, in addition, her most recent book, The Force of Kindness, has a CD tucked in the back with four guided meditations, which is quite wonderful to have someone guiding us through it. So I do recommend those two items as well. So then, loving kindness is the foundation practice. It's really the foundation energy. We need to cultivate loving kindness in order for the others to unfold. It is said that of the four, loving kindness can be the easiest, although occasionally people mention to me that it's easier for them compassion, for example. So I'm guessing that probably compassion and loving kindness, that they're, it would be one or the other that you might feel the strongest with, and then from that window strengthen the other. And then sympathetic joy is a bit harder, appreciative joy, because, you know, when someone else has a lot of success or something happens, you know, there's what creeps in is jealousy, envy, or just this horrible feeling that we're not doing well, we're failing, that kind of thing. So that's a little, it's a little bit more mature. It goes through strong loving kindness, strong compassion. However, the example, and we'll talk about it next week, that I always give, babies, puppies, kittens. Because, of course, you know, you go in the grocery store and someone has a small baby that's just so happy. And we just feel happy. And rarely do we feel jealous or envious of the baby. So we're just able to feel, or when we have so many people, their grandchildren or nieces, nephews, or well as their own children, to just gladden the heart, just the thought of the baby. And even some people as they get older, particularly young people, will be embarrassed or frustrated when their parents refer to some really cute thing they did when they were tiny. And I think it's part of it is the parents, grandparents were remembering that feeling. It's just such a sweet feeling. Mudita, appreciative joy. It's just joy that another is joyful. Without jealousy, without envy, just that pure joy. And of course, puppies, kittens, flowers, that's why we give flowers. That's the same feeling. You look at flowers, daffodils. I mean, aren't they just mudita? Just shouting, mudita, joy. So that's the feeling of joy. And then we'll talk about equanimity as a feeling of balance and equalness. We cultivate it so that we can feel equal loving kindness, equal compassion to eventually all beings. We work our way there from the people we care about. And then also that we can have some balance of heart. Because part of the reason that we're often as we grow, we close our hearts, is because it's really hard to have an open heart, to love and to have compassion. Because sometimes, quite often, people we care about, we love a lot, will still be in difficulty or distress. We'll still be doing things that are self-destructive and so forth. So, or compassion, too, that we can care so much, and yet this world is full of suffering, and suffering continues. So then to have the ability to keep the heart open in the face of difficulty, distress, and suffering is something we actually have to cultivate. It doesn't come easily with it doesn't come with the package. So it, again, we cultivate it, and that's the equanimity practice. So then the four become a development over time that strengthens and opens the heart. And then we progress to a point with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the saints and sages, who experience immeasurable loving kindness, is metta in Pali. Compassion, immeasurable compassion is karuna. Immeasurable joy, mudita. And immeasurable equanimity is upekkha in Pali. So it's a progression, and we learn to use the practices to train, to develop, to progress, to unfold the heart, opening the heart little by little. So then last week I mentioned that at the end that the proximate cause of feeling loving kindness toward any being is seeing the goodness in them, seeing their goodness. And then those of you who were here, we had a little homework. Someone asked a wonderful question. They were talking about how, you know, sometimes we're doing our loving kindness practice and we get to aunt so-and-so and cousin so-and-so, and it's a little bit difficult to feel the loving kindness toward them. Yet we have this should, you know, they're my relatives, I should, they got to be on the list, right? So then to reflect on a good quality, some aspect of goodness, that's the proximate cause. The proximate cause of anything is among the causes, it's the one that occurs just before the thing happens. So we, you know, in the garden, we're coming to the spring garden, we have the soil and the fertilizer and the bulbs, not the bulbs, the seeds, and raking and so we plant the whole thing. But the proximate cause would probably be water, rain, something in most situations, in sunlight maybe. So that kind of thing, the proximate cause for the candle that we have at home to bring light would be that we strike a match and hold it to the wick. So the proximate cause to feel loving kindness for others or for yourself is to see goodness. So seeing your own goodness also becomes an important part of developing loving kindness toward yourself, particularly if you have a lot of self-judgment and self-criticism. What that turns out quite often to be is a habit, a repetitive habit of thinking of your weaknesses and your difficult things and the things you don't like about yourself. But if anybody here had to make a list, if we really were truthful, we could have at least as long of a list of good qualities and good things that we've done. And certainly the people that like you would add to the list. And so to be able to develop intentionally the habit of reflecting on our goodness as well, our good qualities. Now, of course, we feel a little embarrassed about that, and we have these funny, I always say the one that I heard when I was young was, don't break your arm, but patting yourself on the back. So there, whatever background we have, there will be the cultural put-down kind of that relates to that. And often the adults, there's a little bit possibly of jealousy and envy involved there when they see, you know, when we were little and we were just so full of ourselves and that feeling. Now we have the phrase, damn, I'm good. But, you know, when you're young and then some adult, maybe it's a little jealousy or envy and you'll get that phrase, well, hey, don't pat yourself. Don't break your arm, pat yourself on the back. So then we get this feeling of embarrassment, like it's not okay to enjoy our own good qualities. But it is okay, and it's necessary in order for loving kindness to arise. So if we weren't allowed to enjoy our own goodness and to see that, then we didn't have the proximate cause for the arising of loving kindness. So obviously, later we wouldn't have the experience of loving kindness for ourselves. So part of this practice, part of your homework, I assign you this homework, is to allow yourself to reflect on your own goodness and your own good qualities. So if you need to have permission, it's now an assignment. You must do this. You must do this on a daily basis. It's the proximate cause. If not, you're not going to be able to feel the arising of loving kindness. And then reflecting on the goodness of others. So again, the skillful technique with the Brahma Vihara practice of using the benefactor is to start with someone who we already feel really good about. They have benefited us. That's their major good quality, is that they've benefited us a lot. So they are our benefactor. So that's the way it is. As the Buddha even said, you know, that the being most dear to beings is themselves. So that's just the way it is. It's okay. So we reflect on the goodness of others to give rise to loving kindness, and we start with the benefactor because it's easy. And then ourselves. In the Asian countries, you start with yourself. The way I've patterned it, you saw, I did just one verse toward myself, and then I brought the benefactor in. And that's just the practical realization that most of us, many of us in the West, when we think of ourselves, immediately metta doesn't arise automatically. We've got this other thing going on, our self-criticism and self-judgment. So then we use the benefactor to really bring up the energy. And then we go to ourselves, and you can imagine, even if you need to, the benefactor with their arm or possibly their paw around you. Even say the phrases, may we be happy and peaceful, may we be healthy and strong, if it's hard for you to say them toward yourself. But eventually it'll get easier and easier, and particularly as you reflect on your own goodness. And then we bring in the dear ones. And once again, that's easy. But then as we expand outward, it gets a little bit harder. So we talked about thinking, if you know, cousin so-and-so, just the loving kindness, it feels rote, then let yourself reflect for just a minute or two, find a good quality. You know, maybe they taught you double dutch jump rope when you were a kid. Maybe they, you know, something like that, some quality that allows you to see their goodness. And then we start to expand outward more, and it can be more difficult, which is why I often mention when we're talking about others that we haven't met, this enormous number of people that we have never met who we rely on for our own benefit. Think of the people who are working to fill the potholes. They're working overtime this season. And we benefit so much from that. We save a lot of money because some of those potholes are really big, and if we go in, our car is damaged. But we've never met those people. They have families. This season their families are missing them, and so forth. The people who grow our food, who ship our food, who make our clothing, people who protect us. People who have built our cars, built our houses, people who go out in the storms and repair the electricity, take down trees that are blocking. So many people we directly benefit, and we've never met any of them, many of them, most of them. So that thought, again, their goodness. And of course, skillfully, we think of their goodness by our own benefit. That's just the way it is for us as humans. But eventually, of course, the heart expands and we realize so much goodness of others, not so much directly related to us. But we begin to get the habit of seeing the goodness of others, imagining the goodness of others. Then, of course, there's the category of difficult people. Sometimes that's difficult. What I find so funny about us in the modern world is that some of the people on our most difficult people list, we've never even met, have we? We've just heard about them on the radio. We've heard their voices, maybe. If we can deal with their voice before we turn the radio on. People tell me that a lot, that it's true for me too. Or we've heard tell of them, but we've never actually met them. Now, isn't that odd? But it's a situation of modern reality because of our news media that we've heard about so many people that we've actually never met. So we just know gossip, really, about people. Some of the people on our most difficult person list, we actually don't know for a fact. We just know gossip. So that's pretty odd and unusual. But in any case, because that's the way it is for us, we need to try to imagine their good qualities. And I remember someone talking about, from years past, a president that they had difficulty with. But that president was the owner of a breed of dogs that they also had and loved. So they could use that, you know, someone who loves beagles, or in my case, corgis, can't be all bad, you know? So that sort of thing. Or Pema Chodron speaks of a woman trying to really feel some loving kindness and some compassion for her father. And it was a very, very difficult situation. But then she remembered how much her father loved coffee, his cup of coffee in the morning. And of course, many can relate to that. You know, anybody who loves coffee, we can imagine that feeling and be connected with that. Or other good qualities and so forth. So there's a bit of, this practice is very intentionally oriented. We do the phrases intentionally. There are thoughts. We imagine good qualities, we think of goodness. So it's a very active, relative world practice. But it's an honest practice. We realize that it would be lovely to have loving kindness for all beings, but in fact, that's not where we are. We know that. So we take a practice with specific techniques and with humility, we train. And we find that over time, it changes, and we do change. Because the techniques have been developed over centuries and so skillfully, they really will work if we give them a chance to engage them and spend some time. Now again, we're here in the 21st century. We have situations that weren't even dreamt of in the early centuries of these practices. So we can be creative. For example, I have in the correspondence course some people who do loving kindness practice on their treadmill. So they get some exercise in and the loving kindness. And then I have a good friend, when I told her about that, her eyes lit up and she now does loving kindness laps. Her swimming pool time, her loving kindness laps. And she says it's been so great now, not only for the loving kindness practice, but also for her health, because now that she dedicates a whole lap to each person on her dear ones list, she doesn't ever shorten her swim time, you know, because then she feels a little, oh no, I didn't do the lap for these particular people. So I think that's really very skillful application. And then of course our challenge with difficult people and feeling empathy is, again, ordinary world, driving our cars on the freeways. Can we think a good thought about the person who cut us off? Why do we always assume that they somehow know us personally, woke up in the morning with the thought, I'm going to cut Jude off and ruin her day? I mean, that's the reaction we have. But really, most of the people that cut us off are complete strangers. And, you know, generally speaking, by definition of driving, they didn't see us. And yet we react as though they intentionally saw us and thought, when will I cut her off? Now, I'll do it. That's our reaction. So instead, to be able to let go of that and realize, you know, if they'd seen us, they probably wouldn't have done it. They're probably really happy we have good breaks. We're happy we have good breaks. So again, softening the situation a bit and reaching our heart, stretching our heart. My Tibetan teacher said that after years of beginning to understand Westerners, he said one thing that he realizes is that so many of us have wounded love. which I thought was such a good way to put it. We have wounded love. And he said, actually, in the modern, now the modern situation with the Tibetans, it's like modern life, and of course, so difficult with the Cultural Revolution in China and so forth, that Tibetans are beginning to seem to also be experiencing this feeling of wounded love that has happened through the vicissitudes of life. So to be able to cultivate and heal this loving kindness toward ourselves and toward others, we could call it friendliness. We don't have to call it love. We can call it kindness. We can call it friendliness. An open-heartedness, a softening of the heart. Caring, tender-hearted caring. So we have these practices, and they will help. They really do help. I can testify over time. They help our hearts heal. They help our hearts grow. So we spend a lot of time with the loving kindness practice. We also develop it more. We spend more time with the easier categories. Only challenge yourself a little with the difficult. And only if you haven't done this before, don't start with the most difficult being in your whole life. When you get, you know, work with yourself, with the benefactor, with the dear ones, and then a little bit to a moderately difficult person. Then come back to yourself, the benefactor, the dear ones. Just kind of a touch and go. I always compare this, give you an image of it. When you go into the gym, you start with the lightweights. You do the most reps with the lightweights. You only do a little time with the heavier weights. You go back to the lightweights. But over time, you get stronger. So that's the way to think of the loving kindness. Stay with the lighter ones, more reps, and then only a little bit, little bit, little bit with the heavier ones, and go back to the lighter ones. And then you'll strengthen, your heart will strengthen, it will get easier as you go along. So that's spending most of our time strengthening loving kindness. And then the second step, the second Brahmavihara, is compassion, karuna, to cultivate compassion for others. Some people find that easy and they're really blessed. It's a real gift if your heart easily opens to compassion for the sufferings of others. Some people have a lot of difficulty with this. Pema Chodron spoke, I was at Gampo Abbey for a couple of months a few years ago at the Yarni retreat, shaved my head with ordained temporarily, and she's a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And I just always have to say, she's, you know, she's as good as her books. Sometimes people, you're not sure, but I'll tell you, she's just amazing, truly wonderful. But she said that frequently people will come up to her and say they don't know how to feel compassion. It's just not something they've learned how to feel. So learning to train ourselves to feel compassion, empathy for the suffering of others, is a very powerful thing, but it's perfectly legitimate if we don't know how to feel that. We can learn, we can train. So the proximate cause for the rising of compassion is seeing someone suffering. Seeing their pain. So it's a different feeling, right? Proximate cause of feeling loving kindness, friendliness, is seeing their goodness. Proximate cause of feeling compassion, having compassion arise, is being able to see someone suffering, to see their pain. So in the guided meditation, we saw that the first being we start with in order to feel compassion isn't our loving kindness benefactor. Instead, we think of a being, or maybe a group of beings. Pema said that for her, she always thought of the animals that undergo experimentation, that group of beings will always bring compassion to her heart. So it may be, or it might be someone that we care about. For this first category, when we're intentionally practicing compassion, we should be a little cautious that it isn't someone that we are so close to and they are suffering so much that compassion will slide into grief. Not because there's anything wrong with grief, but just because we do want to feel the feeling of compassion, just to get that feeling clear. Then later, of course, we would include them, the person who we are close to who is in such difficulty. We can include them in our practice, certainly. But the first being, again, to get the right note, like with the pitch pipe, we want, so a being, we feel compassion quite easily because we care, so that we can feel that feeling. And then there are various phrases that you might find. Usually there's just one or two. The ones I said were ones I developed over time leading, mostly it was developed over leading this women's group I have in loving kindness and then compassion. That it seemed nice to have a rhythm of several phrases. So that was my modification. But one first one that's helpful is to be able to say, I care about this pain. I care about your pain. Or then the next being is ourselves. So then we think of some difficulty or distress that we are having. And then we just allow ourselves to say, I care about this pain. I care about my pain. And there's such a feeling there, just to care. Often, we have closed our hearts to compassion for others' suffering, because we have felt, maybe not consciously, but more intuitively or subconsciously, just that if we care, it means we have to solve it. And we feel so overwhelmed by certain difficulties in the world or maybe the people that we know that we feel there's no way we're going to be able to solve that. So then we somehow feel, well, then I've got to hold back. I can't really care about that pain. My example of that, I had sort of heard this teaching and understood it, but I saw it vividly in myself. When you remember the novel about the suffering in Calcutta and the minister that goes there. Do you remember the name of it?
City of God.
City of God, right. City of God. So I picked up this novel. It's an amazing, amazing book. And it's about a young Christian minister who goes to serve among the lepers in Calcutta. And I started to read that. And just a few pages in, I was overwhelmed with a feeling, but I wasn't so clear about what it was. But since at that time I was the cook at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, I was in a context where I allowed myself to look and see what's going on here. What am I actually feeling? Because I couldn't even read the book, and I was just overwhelmed with something. And what I realized was, as I watched my mind, was it was this feeling that I had wasted my entire life, that I had done nothing useful at all, just completely overwhelmed with this sense of the suffering in Calcutta. But what I saw when I looked at it was, what was I thinking? You know, that if my life had been different, the suffering in Calcutta would not have arisen. You know, it was like a little bit of what we would call technically conceit. But in the Buddhist tradition, it can be inflation or deflation. But this kind of inflated sense of the power of self. And what I realized that I had this automatic reaction that if I opened my heart to compassion, then I would be obligated to solve something. And then I was so overwhelmed with the idea of solving the suffering in Calcutta that I was just in some bizarre knot of emotion that had stopped me. I couldn't keep reading the book. So then I untangled that and sorted that out and realized a little, just a small amount of equanimity dawned when I realized that, you know, I was a cook at a meditation center, not bad, you know. I put in a lot of years of meditation practice and service. So it was okay, and I could open my heart to the suffering. And, of course, the title of the book is City of Joy. So if you've never read it, it's actually quite an amazing journey because you begin to understand about compassion, about our notions of who's in a better position than who, who's suffering and who isn't, because of the wonderful joy in the community of the lepers in Calcutta. Incredible joy of their lives. So we then begin to understand, oh, we can care about pain. And then, in fact, when we think about it, we realize, you know, there's a lot of situations where we've been difficulty, suffering, and distress, and we tell a friend, and we're not actually expecting them to fix it. But it's so sweet if they just say, oh, I'm sorry. That sounds awful. So we see, you know, we're not asking everybody to solve our lives, to solve our difficulties, but to just say, I care. I care about your pain. I care about this pain. And then the sweet feeling to care about our own pain, to just think of one thing that's really been difficult for us, and then hold ourselves in our own hearts and say, I care about this pain. I care about my pain. Some comfort that comes to us. And then the formal phrase, of course, that we've heard quite often is, may you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And then I've added these others because they seem to, sometimes we can just take the one that applies precisely. But this kind of covers for a group. May you be comforted, supported, cared for, healed. May you be surrounded with every kindness. May you be surrounded with every kindness. Just this last week, a friend in the loving kindness group, one of her dogs had gone missing. And so we had a little telephone tree, and then I sent out an email. And in the sitting group, we surrounded Rosebud with kindness. We also wanted to call her home, and that somehow she would be returned to her mom. But we realized that if that couldn't happen, at least could she be surrounded with kindness? Because then that would be okay. You know, for any of us, if any of our pets went go missing, at least then could they be surrounded with kindness? Then we're okay. You know, if we could know that for a fact. Certainly when we have to, if our situation changes and we have to give away a pet, we can no longer keep it, that's what we look for. If they would be in a situation of kindness. So then to imagine that all beings in any kind of distress, difficulty, illness, loneliness, and some of the mental torment that people go through, the emotional torment, may they be surrounded with kindness. This compassion, this sense of wishing others kindness. And for ourselves too, may we be surrounded with kindness. May all beings be surrounded with kindness. So that is our compassion practice. We work with the cultivation of loving kindness, And then we can shift next to the compassion, and we can do it in that way, imagining someone, some being that we care about, directing compassion to them, compassion to ourselves, and then start to move outward in whatever way we like to do it. We can do it geographically as well. You know, in our loving kindness group, we're just a couple blocks from the hospital. So when we do the compassion practice in Tacoma and we radiate outward geographically, we know that, you know, one direction that we head, there's really a lot of difficulty and distress, suffering, people who are ill, people who are relatives and friends. So it really helps to radiate the loving, the compassion and loving kindness both in that direction toward the hospital. So experiment with that and work with that during the week. And we'll talk a little bit more about it next week. And then we'll move also to appreciative joy. I wanted to read you another teaching, though, by the Buddha. When the monastics were given a forest to meditate in that was either at one point allegedly haunted, but then I think it was more that it had to have a lot of poisonous snakes. So they were afraid, and they came to the Buddha. They always came to the Buddha. And he offered a loving-kindness teaching, because loving-kindness will also antidote fear. It's one of the traditional antidotes of fear. And he offered this teaching according to the number of legs a being has or does not have. Now, I've modified it a little bit, but it's the basic. For those without feet, I have love. I have love for all with 2 feet. For those with 4 feet, I have love. I have love for all with many feet. May those without feet be healed, happy, and strong. May those with 2 feet be healed, happy, and strong. May those with 4 feet be healed, happy, and strong. May all those with many feet be healed, happy, and strong. May all beings, all living things, all who've come to be, one and all, may they see every blessing. May no evil at all come to them. And someone sent me a modern poem that's similar, that I really like. It's by James Collar, and it's called Benediction for the Animals. My paw is holy. Birds are everywhere. My paw. Herbs are everywhere. My paw is holy. Everything is holy. My paw. Everything is holy. And then I collect various items, and this one, much more modern, it's a song lyric by Mike Scott. Me, it really speaks of this, the heart opening of compassion. It's called Bring Them All In. Some of you may know. Bring them all in, bring them all in, bring them all in. Bring them all in, bring them all into my heart. Bring them all in, bring them all in, bring them all in. Bring them all into my heart. Bring the little fishes. Bring the sharks. Bring them from the brightness. Bring them from the dark. Bring them from the caverns. Bring them from the heights. Bring them from the shadows. Stand them in the light. Bring them out of purdah. Bring them out of store. Bring them out of hiding. Lay them at my door. Bring the unforgiven. Bring the unredeemed. Bring the lost. the nameless. Let them all be seen. Bring them out of exile. Bring them out of sleep. Bring them to the portal. Lay them at my feet. Bring them all in. Bring them all in. Bring them all in. Bring them all into my heart. Bring them all in. Bring them all in. Bring them all into my heart. So, thank you all. So we have some time for questions and for announcements. I could read my poem. Yes.
Briefly about the near and far enemies of compassion. I think you sort of mentioned it.
Yeah.
I think that sort of ties
from
pity, I think.
I'm trying to remember. Pity is the near enemy. You can feel that. Pity, near enemy of compassion. I can't remember what the far enemy is.
Indifference.
I thought indifference was the far enemy of equanimity. But I'm not certain. I'll look it all up.
Okay.
Pity you can see. Cruelty. Cruelty is the far enemy of compassion. Hatred is the far enemy of loving kindness. And disinterestedness, indifference is the far enemy of equanimity. I'll make a list. I'm sure I have the list. My apartment looks like an explosion in a paper factory. So I will unearth that list and bring it to you and present it to you more formally. it might even be actually in the folder for the final week. It's possible. Yes.
How do you start with loving kindness?
Loving kindness practice. Again, many of the teachers would do a little bit of it, the Theravada teachers that I started with, practicing with in like the 70s. Wasn't so much in Zen, which I did in the 60s. But then the Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and a few of their friends went to Burma and studied intensive loving kindness practice with Saito Ukambika. And then Sharon brought that back and started allowing those of us, at first we just requested, like there was a 3-month retreat, and I'd done some 3-month retreats with insight meditation practice, so I asked her, would she teach it to me for the whole 3 months? So she did, and then she started, more people started doing that, and then her book came out and so forth. So that book, I was so delighted to tell her when I went to New Zealand and was staying briefly at the Bodhihinayana Rama Monastery, which is an Amaravati satellite monastery in New Zealand. The Western monks there, one of them was reading her book and said that they were all passing it around. So. He said to particularly tell Sharon that they were all so delighted that she had written such a fine, really it's a manual in of the whole full practice. So it was, I thought it was kind of neat because the Burmese style of the cultivation was getting its way into the Thai practice through Sharon, through the Western monks in New Zealand and so forth. So. A kind of wonderful thing that's going on. Just this 20th, 21st century stories of how these various practices, Buddhist practices, coming to the West in their various guises and then traveling back to Asia and touching each other, traditions that had only heard of each other, maybe had some prejudices against each other. I remember one time talking to one particular teacher of one tradition and realizing that I actually knew a lot more about the other tradition experientially than that teacher did. because even though those Asian countries were adjacent, I had graduate courses in meditation in those two traditions in San Francisco when I was there. So I had training that just wasn't available to the Asian teachers. So fascinating things are happening. The Tibetans say that there hadn't been, in their tradition, it's since the 17th century, such an explosion of lay people meditating. I mean, in the Asian countries, it was monastics that meditated. And then here, the late 20th century, early 21st century, there are all these wild Westerners doing intensive meditation practice, not in monasteries, just in life. It's quite an extraordinary time. So we can be kind of excited about what's going on here. Other questions? Let me read one more. Many of you have heard me read this, but it's one of my favorites about compassion. And it's by Naomi Shihab Nye, who's an Arab American, particularly beautiful. Lived a lot in the United States, Southwest, so you can feel the Southwest is here in the poem. It's called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out in the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.